your shoulder with ease, comment on the cover or the images, or ask whether the book is a good one. What is it about? Why do you want to read it? Your activity can serve as a catalyst for a conversation. In contrast, phones are not transparent, as Susan Dominus pointed out in a wistful essay entitled Motherhood Screened Off. She writes that whenever she grabs her phone, her children know that she is also holding a portal as magical as the one in Narnia's wardrobe and with the same potential to transport me to another world or infinite worlds. How far am I going? They might reasonably worry, and how soon will I be back? In addition to the vagueness and inaccessibility of what you are doing on screen, the fact that you can instantly swipe and hide it further closes you off to your child. It's true that grown-ups enjoy many diversions to which children should not be privy. This is part of the allure and mystery of adulthood. But texting is not mysterious, it's covert. Mysterious would be where mom and dad go on date night. Covert is exclusionary, a barrier. Your baby, and later your toddler, child, and teenager, can get to know you by the books and magazines you read, the music you love, the teams you root for. When you're with your child, would you wear headphones to listen to music or follow a game? That would shut her out of the action. In the same way, letting her see what you're reading is a way to invite her into your world. Considering how much of her inner life you'll hope she will reveal to you in the years to come, sharing your own experiences now seem the comradely thing to do. Gadgets as babysitters. A young mom sits at a restaurant with her curly-haired boy snuggled in her lap, feeding him forkfuls of rice and vegetables. He squeaks, and she murmurs something in his ear. Then I see what he's squeaking at, a phone propped sideways where a teensy cartoon is playing. You may be thinking, what's wrong with that? They're both happy. It's just a bit of entertainment. Relax already. I choose this scene to introduce the topic of iPads or phones as babysitters precisely because it's such a loving and innocent vignette. The trouble is, it is very likely occurring not once a week, but multiple times a day. The research on young children using devices is ongoing, but as far as language development is concerned, the findings are not favorable. Adults admit they are addicted to their devices, and there is science that supports the use of that word. Smartphones activate several parts of the brain that lead to compulsive behavior. From an evolutionary standpoint, we are driven to seek. The neurotransmitter dopamine compels us to seek information, new experiences, and basics such as food and sex. Previously, it was believed that dopamine controlled the brain's pleasure systems, but new studies reveal a more complex process. We feel pleasure when we seek and then find. Finding activates the opioid pleasure response. Neurologically speaking, we crave seeking as much as finding. Our phones allow us to seek information endlessly. The seek and find pleasure is intensified if you don't know what you'll find or when you'll find it. Psychologists call this phenomenon variable reinforcement. Text messages, tweets, and email arrive at unpredictable or variable times, prodding us to look and see the new information. The chimes that announce them tick another box on the compulsion list, the Pavlovian response. None of this is coincidental. As longtime tech executive Bill Davidow reported in 2012, many internet companies are learning what the tobacco industry has long known. Addiction is good for business. There is little doubt that by applying current neuroscience techniques, we will be able to create ever more compelling obsessions in the virtual world. So parents are correct when they say they're addicted. Research is ongoing, but the sponge-like brains of babies and toddlers should be protected from exposure to the addictive power of screens. Parents who defend their baby's use of devices may claim that it's educational or my child loves it. Linda Stone, a tech executive, theorist, and coiner of the phrase, continuous partial attention, disagrees. We may think that kids have a natural fascination with phones. Really, children have a fascination with whatever mom and dad find fascinating. If they are fascinated by the flowers coming up in the yard, that's what the children are going to find fascinating. And if mom and dad can't put down the device with the screen, the child is going to think, that's where it's all at. That's where I need to be. The American Academy of Pediatrics, AAP, has long advised parents not to allow any child under 2 to use a smartphone or tablet because of the potential delays in language development that are linked to such usage. They say neuroscience research shows that very young children learn best via two-way communication. Talk time between caregiver and child remains critical for language development. In 2016, the AAP tweaked their position, saying that some media can have educational value for children starting at around 18 months of age, but it's critically important that this be high-quality programming, such as the content offered by Sesame Workshop and PBS. Problems begin when media use displaces physical activity, hands-on exploration, and face-to-face social interaction in the real world, which is critical to learning. Too much screen time can also harm the amount and quality of sleep. Currently, there are no studies that link speech and language delays in elementary and high school students exclusively to the amount of time they spent on devices when they were very young. But a nationwide study of students in the UK found that between 2007 and 2011, the number of school children needing expert help for speech and language difficulties rose 71%. iPhones first became available in January 2007. Sleep, noise, and the music of the tribe. There are times when you don't need to entertain your child with a device or anything else. Babies do occasionally sleep, and getting them down soon becomes the parent's passionate fixation. That's the reason for all the lullabies, the electronic vibrating crib rocker, and the endless replays of Hawaiian slack string guitar tunes, or whatever random music baby has glommed onto as a sedative. Once he's nodded off, there's a tendency to tiptoe around and keep the house as silent as possible, lest a raised voice wake him again. The soundscape of your child's world is vital to his development. Yet just as an immaculate, germ-free environment reduces immunity to infection, there's no need to shush everyone up and create an unnaturally quiet zone at home just because baby is sleeping. While nothing soothes a newborn as powerfully as his parents' voice, he's also calmed by the other sounds of your tribe, which sifted through while he was in utero. The vacuum cleaner down the hall, the dog barking at the doorbell, big sister's rhythmic spring as she jumps on the couch. These are an old, familiar soundtrack. He's more comfortable with your family's nearby rumble than with the lonely silence of an isolated nursery. The baby monitor calms your nerves, but not his. Besides, almost any infant under the age of one is capable of falling asleep in a train wreck. You've seen them snoozing on Dad's shoulder in the middle of a boisterous birthday party. That said, babies should not be exposed to excessive noise outside the home. Their hearing is very sensitive, so you'll want to protect your little one from harsh, jarring, or high decibel sounds. He'll look like a sweet lamb in the busy restaurant or at the outdoor festival, staring at the lights or dozing off, but you'll pay with an overstimulated, sleepless baby at 2 a.m. More important, the noise could damage his hearing. Amplified music, revving car engines, the roar of large crowds, such as at sporting events, and other loud noises may cause permanent hearing loss in babies and young children. Because their skulls are thinner than those of adults, the inner ear is more vulnerable. Noise-canceling headphones for babies and children are inexpensive and easy to find online. If you think you might be in situations where your baby could be exposed to very loud noises, these are must-have accessories. Silent stewardship. When to be your baby's quiet companion. Human beings have always used silence as a balm for the soul. The meditation room, the mountain hike, the secluded corner of a library. Silence is invaluable to babies as well. Not as a precursor to nap time, but as a gateway to the self. There are two powerful reasons for cultivating companionable silence with your baby. The first is practical and educational, the second more profound. When babies are trying to solve problems at newly emerging edges of their competency, it's best for parents to refrain from jumping in too quickly with help, including verbal guidance. This is different from narrating daily rituals, and it requires some attentiveness on the part of the parent. Deborah Carlisle Solomon, an enlightened and experienced educator, told me that teaching mothers not to talk, not to point, not even to ask questions directed toward solutions is at the core of her infant-toddler curriculum. Sitting in on a Mommy and Me class, I saw the parents' anxiety around this seemingly simple edict. Parents and babies were seated on a large flannel sheet strewn with toys. 8-month-old Wyatt was stretching his arm toward a soft fabric ball that rested on a fold in the sheet just beyond his grasp. Wyatt eyed the ball, grunting softly. His mother, seeing his effort, automatically reached out to slide it closer to him while describing her perception of his desire. "You want the ball." "Wait," the group facilitator softly coached her. "Let's watch and see what happens." Young Wyatt was intent, determined, but not distressed. His grunting continued. Now mother was suffering more than child. It would be so easy to help. Suddenly Wyatt changed his strategy. Instead of reaching for the ball, he grabbed the sheet in his fist and pulled it with just enough force to release the ball from its fold, causing it to slide straight toward his waiting hand. The baby beamed. His mother exhaled. "I know that was hard to watch at first, but look at Wyatt now," said Lisa. That ball is gold. If you had made it easy for him to reach, it would still be a ball. Sit on your hands. Imagine you have duct tape on your mouth. Wait a few seconds before offering aid. Use any trick to stop yourself from interfering with Wyatt's opportunity to talk himself through a problem. Not long after observing Wyatt, I spent the morning at the beach. There I befriended Jenny, mother of 2-year-old Theo. We watched as Theo filled his bucket with sand, poured the sand through a sieve, and did it all over again. And again. Sometimes he narrated the action by naming his equipment. Bucket! Shovel! Other times he softly chanted, Sando, Sando, Sando. But most of his moves required such deep concentration that he worked in silence. Jenny told me he had been at it for 20 minutes. I keep reminding myself not to interrupt with a lesson, to just let him be. By controlling herself, Jenny granted Theo the opportunity to keep himself company. This is the second reason for practicing silent stewardship. The comfort of quiet camaraderie enables a child to begin to learn self-talk, the habit of positive internal dialogue. As he grows, self-talk will act as a powerful protectant against insecurity, anxious rumination, and frantic avoidance of boredom. Solitary play is critically different from the way a small child interacts with an electronic device. Psychologist and sociologist Sherry Turkle teaches and studies the impact of technology on human relationships at MIT. She warns, learning about solitude and being alone is the bedrock of early development, and you don't want your kids to miss out on that because you're pacifying them with a device. They need to be able to explore their imagination, to be able to gather themselves and know who they are, so someday they can form a relationship with another person without a panic of being alone. If you don't teach your children to be alone, they'll only know how to be lonely. Patient, silent stewardship, like any spiritual practice, takes self-discipline, conviction, and courage. In a world of anxious ambition, intruding on your child's relationship with himself can feel like enrichment. Not getting involved at every turn can feel like neglect. I'm ever more impressed when I see parents who recognize that often when adults do less, children can do more. As children leave the toddler stage, their language acquisition picks up steam and their personalities blossom. We're entering full-blown childhood, land of long-winded stories, far-fetched excuses, outrageous misinterpretations, and future family legends. Keep your eyes and ears open. Chapter 2. The Great Cathedral Space of Childhood. Learning the language of your child's world. Boys and girls, ages 3-11. Is childhood the same in all eras, or is it defined by the adults who stand at its gates? Our modern experience of child-rearing is often tense and apprehensive. We listen to our children on the fly or half-listen. Hurry causes us to try to maximize every interaction. Hence, spelling words threaded into bedtime stories, and forced debriefings on the drive from school to practice. In our rush, we make careless assumptions or act on emotion rather than taking time to reflect. Instead of unfiltered and meandering conversations, much adult-to-child communication is heavy on suggestions, reminders, and warnings. Just sitting with a child and listening, offering occasional observations or questions, not checking a phone, may seem like a lost art. But you can start with 5 uninterrupted minutes, or even 2. Those minutes with your one-of-a-kind yet changed-today-from-yesterday little person will yield surprising treasure and lead you to want more. The world has changed dramatically in recent decades, but the conditions for a happy childhood remain simple. Food, shelter, security, a healthy amount of unstructured time, and a parent eager to hear about the day's adventures. Virginia Woolf wrote of her mother, "There she was, in the very center of that great cathedral space which was childhood." A parent defines childhood not only by supplying a warm home, but also by being at its center, ready to listen and willing to talk. 3 fundamental truths about children. Although children may beckon you to realms of enchantment, life can be hell when you're deep in the trenches of a typical day with them. And unlike any other social activity, it is not optional. When the ancient Jewish sages referred to Tsar Gadul Banim, Hebrew for the pain of raising children, they were acknowledging both the urgency and the seeming futility of getting your message across to distracted, contrary, ignorant, self-centered little fools. But a portion of the rough spots encountered each day may be smoothed by understanding 3 fundamental truths. If these seem self-evident and therefore easy to incorporate into your heart, worldview, and child-rearing routine, you are probably new to parenting. 1. Boys and girls are different. They see and hear differently, learn differently, progress at different rates, find different situations and sounds amusing, and respond to different styles of verbal and nonverbal interactions. It's true that blunt or old-fashioned stereotypes can cause harm by narrowing or distorting our view of individual children, and there are many characteristics that boys and girls have in common. But parents and other adults need to appreciate the distinctive traits of each child while also accepting the existence of typical gender differences. 2. Your child's bad behavior doesn't make you a bad parent. You can't take a child's bad behavior personally. With few exceptions, their willfulness, petulance, resistance to reason, and otherwise crabby or insulting behavior is not a reflection of how much they love you or a barometer of your skill as a parent. There are many other influences in their lives: daily struggles, humiliations, unfulfilled longings, frustrations, and disappointment. Just like the mess at the bottom of their backpacks, they lug it all home. If they didn't feel you could take it, they wouldn't hurl their emotional junk your way. 3. Today is a snapshot, not the epic movie of your child's life. Children are constantly evolving. Today is not predictive of much. Not tomorrow, not the middle school years, not their eventual career, not what your relationship with them will be like when they've matured. In a world of constant ranking and rating, it's wildly countercultural to take a wait-and-see approach, but it is essential. One final suggestion before we start our study of conversation. When talking with children, pretend you're an armchair traveler or cultural anthropologist. What are the ways of these people? What are their traditions, their beliefs? Whom do they admire and why? What are they striving for? As you enter their land, let an open mind, curiosity, and courage be your guide. Vocal coaching, lesson one. The tune matters as much as the lyrics. Artists, musicians, and writers are always urged to find their voice, meaning the truest expression of who they are. In everyday life, our voice transmits not just literal information, but also clues to the soul bubbling beneath. Your rhythm, tone, warmth or aloof distance, breathlessness or drawl, matter to your child as much or more than the words you say. When your daughter reflects on her childhood, she'll recall the delight in your greetings and the irritation in your shouted commands, the lilt of your pet names for her, your chuckle or disapproving snort. Your son will remember the zest with which you cheered him, your repetitious cautionary speeches, the rage-propelled threats, the gentleness of your songs at bedtime. A great portion of what we appreciate, desire, and fear for our children comes through in the quality of our voice. And most of the time, we have no idea how we sound to them. My voice lessons with parents often begin with a call like the one I received from a distraught mother. "We have an emergency with our daughter, Ruby. She's awful in every way. It's a nightmare." The woman was speaking in a pressured whisper. I envisioned her hiding out in the bathroom. "We need to see you as soon as possible. We'll cancel anything." "How old is Ruby?"
"Four."
"Four?" From her mother's panic, I would have guessed 15. But four-year-old girls can blindside their parents, transforming in weeks from grinning toddlers into glittery pink despots. She's so sweet, a charming sidekick, and then one day, Bellatrix Lestrange shows up and won't leave. And the parents' confidence begins to falter. I met with Ruby's mom and inquired about the composition of the family, Ruby's general physical health, her eating and sleeping patterns, and any difficult experiences she had weathered. I then invited the mom to give me a play-by-play account of some typical recent nightmare scenarios. After hearing a few examples, I smiled and interrupted. "Whoa, I wish I had filmed you just now. You'd be able to hear how much your tone changed. Your voice got really high. You narrowed your eyes, tensed your jaw and your shoulders, started flapping your arms and pointing. Do you think that happens when you're talking to Ruby?"
"Probably, because I'm furious. She's so mean to me."
At four, mean words come from frustration, anxiety, or fatigue. Ruby melts down with the people she loves and trusts the most, and that's you.
"But she does it at birthday parties, and even with my parents, it's so embarrassing."
Let's try a new approach here. Instead of attempting to figure out the where, when, and why of Ruby's provocative behavior, or what kind of consequences might help her exercise more self-control, let's work on one simple change. Let's try a little vocal coaching. The basic voice lesson I teach involves pitch, speed, tone, and body language. 1. When you start to feel tense while talking to a child of any age, relax your facial muscles and shoulders. Rest your hands in your lap. No pointing. 2. Take a deep breath. Consciously lower your pitch and slow your rate of speech. 3. Don't use a patronizing or babyish tone. I conduct a similar exercise with all my new clients. I ask them to describe in detail a situation that led to an argument or meltdown with their child. Where were they in the house? What time of day was it? When had they last eaten? Inevitably, as the parent tells the story, she gets exasperated, and her voice rises just as it did at the time of the incident. This high-pitched, strained voice communicates indignation, fear, and lack of authority. It's nearly as common among fathers as mothers. As soon as the parent's voice goes up, roles shift. The child may now view the parent as a taunting older sibling or a whimpering younger one. As the child fights back or signals that he stopped listening, the parent's frustration increases. The weak vocal message is now accompanied by alarmed or submissive nonverbal cues, hunched shoulders, open mouth, those gesticulating hands. When a strong parent shrinks and withers, the child rises up. He sees and hears, not in words, but in pitch and tone, that he's winning the round. This child does not feel the thrill of victory. Although it's not conscious, he feels afraid. Afraid and powerful. A bad combination. The parent's behavior signals, "I can't handle it when you act like a child." In subsequent sessions with parents, we explore the feelings that are reflected in their stressed voice, pointless repetition, and panicked behavior. At the same time, we practice more voice lessons. If you have a calmer voice, you're going to feel calmer. If you intentionally lower your pitch, your child sees that you can control your feelings and that the situation is not unsettling or even unusual. Children respond by becoming calmer themselves and by ceding power, often gratefully, although they're not aware of it. This, in turn, lets you shift from trying to maintain control or feeling shame over losing it to figuring out why the trouble may have started. A changed vocal tone leads naturally to changed behavior and perspective. You don't have to feel calm to act as if you are and reap all the benefits. Performers, public speakers, and teachers depend on acting as if to make their living. You can learn to do it too. Field terms of the spoken word. I've done lots of talking in my time. I've spent 35 years doing therapy and delivered more than 500 lectures and conference keynotes. As a researcher, I've conducted formal interviews with hundreds of adults and students. But when I began to appreciate the startling improvement in parent-child relationships made possible by small yet specific adjustments to voice and body language, I tapped some new resources, acting coaches and voice teachers. These professionals know which approaches hold listeners' attention or lose it, which inspire engagement and goodwill or irritate and alienate people. Like all disciplines, vocal coaching has its own lexicon. Here are the most common terms. Pitch is the register of your voice. A high pitch is pleasing to infants and pets, but signals loss of power with children older than 2 or 3. A lower pitch demonstrates self-control and authority. Volume is a formidable tool that is frequently abused. Shouting conveys weakness or inspires willed deafness in the listener, while speaking at a medium volume commands respect and serves as a compelling invitation to pay attention.
Tempo is the rate of speech. Speaking quickly can convey excitement or enthusiasm, but also nervousness, displeasure, or agitation. Speaking slowly gives you time to emphasize specific points and gives a child time to process your message. Pausing signals a transition to a new point or gives your child the chance to absorb an idea. For parents, pausing also means listening and keeping quiet, not immediately jumping in or correcting. Tone or timbre is the emotional quality of your voice. It conveys your attitude, for example, preachy, pleased, condescending, curious, bored, nervous, or impressed. Cadence is the rhythm of your speech. While babies love lullabies and a sing-song cadence, older children find it annoying or insulting. Rehearsed speeches have a telltale flat cadence, while rote proclamations or paeans of praise, "That's so awesome," can come across as shallow and insincere. Lexicon is the vocabulary you use with your child. You can expand your children's vocabulary by intentionally using words that are slightly more complex than the ones they currently know, delivered in context, so it's easier for them to grasp the meaning. Facial expressions should match your voice and words, but children will inevitably read things into your expression that you don't intend to display. They may demand, "Why are your lips like that?" when you attempt to conceal frustration. My own daughters would accuse me of making disgust face. It's impossible to maintain absolute control over your expressions, but you can train yourself to become more aware of the movements of your lips, mouth, jaw, and eyebrows. If you're feeling really tense but would prefer not to telegraph it, try a trick used by public speakers. Squeeze your toes. It inconspicuously releases some of the stress. A few words about silence. Quietly waiting for a child to finish his sentence is every bit as essential to a conversation as the way you express yourself. Most beneficial to parent-child exchanges, sitting at eye level with the child, hands folded in lap, making eye contact and refraining from interruption. Stillness and resistance to distraction communicate your desire to hear the story, because what your child has to say is captivating, important, and to be taken seriously. These moments provide children with relief and companionship on the scary shoals of their day. No parent can do this every time their child speaks, but it's worth cultivating these skills because attentive and patient listening is an endangered form of communication despite its payoff. It fixes so many of the problems parents bring to my office. It's free, and like sleeping, it comes naturally, or did, until we all got so busy we forgot how. A template for conversations. By the age of 4, children's conversational repertoire is abloom. They can now speak in full sentences, use complex grammar, and are increasingly able to pepper you with questions and engage in elaborate pretend play. Most young children are entertaining chatterboxes, but this is also the stage when they'll infuriate by ignoring you, dawdling, and arguing. Or they'll use empty patter to hold the floor, frustrating adults who fear that reining them in will lower their self-esteem and joie de vivre. With babies, you bond by communicating through speech, touch, and animated gesture. With children, you get an able conversational partner who wants to tell you everything. True, they'll follow you around right up to the bathroom door and not pause for breath while you're inside. They're stubborn and demanding, exuberant and inquisitive. Your mission? Decrease the potential for tedium or exasperation and increase the possibility of delight. Treat young children with dignity by encouraging them to ponder aloud, inquire about topics that puzzle or frighten them, and tell tall tales. Ask for clarification and elaboration, but tread lightly, not in legal deposition mode, not assuming that the end point will be unearthing a problem or transmitting an essential life lesson. Do lots of listening and remember that children are not looking for downloads of information, but for warm conversational companionship. You're talking to someone whose attention span is limited, so keep requests and instructions brief and deliver them loudly and clearly enough to be heard by a child who might be daydreaming. Busy parents often flip commands over their shoulder as they leave a room. When they don't get an immediate response, they repeat themselves from a farther distance using a testier tone. From the child's perspective, it's like listening to a gruff giant without seeing his expression. His voice sounds mad, but hey, I can't see his face, so I'll take a chance and just ignore him. Watch masterful teachers of young children in the classroom. When they want to communicate important information to a student, they drop to their knees, look the child in the eyes, speak in a low tone, wait a moment, and then ask the child to repeat the message. It's what I call full frontal listening, giving a child your complete attention at eye level with a hand gently resting on the child's shoulder. As soon as children can speak, they begin to sleuth out hypocrisy. They sense the phony public relations pitch. You are going to love science sleepaway camp. They smell the hidden agenda. So, did you raise your hand in class today? Is your teacher giving you enough attention? Are you trying hard or spacing out? They bristle at fake praise, fake pride, and fake interest, because they can tell the difference between authentic appreciation of something they've said or done and an absent-minded, good job. This is where treating children with respect comes into play. I've asked children which parental phrases annoy them the most, as in strikes them as manipulative, passive-aggressive, phony, or wishful thinking. Here are the winners. Just wanted to let you know. You know what? It'll be great. You don't mean that. You know he didn't mean to. Can I talk to you for a sec? Child knows to translate to for 15 miserable minutes. Who did you sit with at lunch? Okay. The tentative pleading nature of ending a sentence with okay undercuts your authority and irritates your child. It implies that they can say, no, it's not okay, which is either not true or the bad kind of power that no child really wants. And finally, be careful. Your tense yet trite and predictable bleat of be careful in the direction of your child riding a tricycle near a driveway is not likely to be helpful. Helpful would be, Madeline, please wait. I want to tell you about the rules of the road. Grown-up term inserted in context. There's a good way to navigate. Big word in context. If you see a driveway, always stop. While you're stopped, look at the street in front of the driveway to see if a car is about to pull in. Also look inside a car that's in a driveway to see if someone is about to back up. An automatic "be careful" called out multiple times each day is a lazy incantation. It is understood by the child as, "I have generalized fear, so don't pay me much mind," or, "I don't trust your judgment, so you don't have to develop any. Just outsource it to me." When chatting with children, especially younger ones, you'll be treated to a display of often comical verbal blunders. Rather than reflexively correcting the mispronunciations, misuse of words, or misinformation about a topic, realize that doing so might limit your child's enthusiasm and make him wary of expressing himself. Instead, you can adopt a "pause and reflect before you correct" approach. Let some mistakes pass and repeat some words or ideas correctly, but without pointing out the error. Now let's take a look at constructive ways to open conversations and explore topics. Conversation openers. Specific observations that show the depth of your attention are a solid way to begin. "I'm interested in the way you drew the cloud formation and the people standing over there. I think I see markers and paint. Looks like there's a story going on in this scene." Close observation of the tools and intentions of your emerging artist is a more compelling way to open a conversation than asking yes or no questions or saying, "Cool picture, great job." By the time children are 4 or 5, they're already suspicious of the open-ended questions parents use when they're fishing for intel. For instance, "What did you do today?" or "How was lunch?" By remembering what they have already told you and then asking for more information, you signal that you're genuinely interested in them, not their achievements or popularity. "Did those tadpoles you're growing in the classroom turn into frogs yet?" Open-ended questions like, "Did you have fun?" are not necessarily anxious or prying, and your child may respond enthusiastically. But if you want to increase the odds of getting more than a one-syllable reply, try fleshing out the details. "Does Dion's family still have that trampoline in the backyard? Did his dad spray the hose on you while you jumped around like he did last time?" If you're chatty and specific, your child will be more likely to respond in kind. One engaging conversational approach is to uncover opportunities for your child to act as a valued consultant. Note, pose these kinds of questions only if you mean it and your child's input will be taken into serious consideration. "Who would you like to join us at the beach? What should we serve for lunch when Addie comes over? Any ideas about how we can make your cousins feel welcome? I'd like to hear the music you pick for the drive. Which do you think is a better choice, parking close to the entrance or the exit of the lot? What do you have in mind for your birthday party? What trick could we teach the puppy next?" This style of questioning dignifies the child by giving her a true mission. It also provides a counterpoint to the routine parent-to-child inquiries necessary to get through the day. "Do you remember what day you have to bring the turtle back to school? Everybody have their seatbelts on? How did this mud get on the couch?" Children's curiosity is often all that's needed to ignite a dialogue. An acquaintance told me how much he enjoyed the company of his 7-year-old nephew. "We ride our bikes every afternoon. Jack is brilliant at conversation openers. He'll ask me, 'Uncle Ryan, who's your favorite Marvel superhero? What made you laugh the longest? Did you ever get your heart broken?'" Expanding the conversation.
There are several strategies for making the conversation more engaging to both you and your child. The easiest is to repeat the child's news and ask follow-up questions. Try to include a specific reference to what the child has told you. It's perfectly fine to say, "I never knew that. Tell me more." But you could also say, "I never knew about the ancient Egyptians. Everybody shaved their heads? Why?" Repeating it means that you were really impressed with the information. Affinity is another approach. "What you're saying reminds me of something that happened when I was in fifth grade. Two girls from my class completely bailed on the field trip to the museum. They never came back to the school bus and later got into big trouble for it. Why do you think they did that?" Slightly scandalous topics intrigue young kids, and because it is your history, not their life, they are safe to express their own imaginative hypotheses about what the girls might have been thinking, or not thinking. Rephrasing a child's comments with a request for clarification will also take you to enlightening places. "Let's see, I think I know what you mean. One part of you wants to sleep at Jasper's and another part isn't sure. Do I have it right? Tell me if this is what you're trying to figure out." Be a willing fellow traveler into the darker realms. Ask for details about their dreams, drawings, and the tragedies and consequences of decisions made by characters in books. Like the silent stewardship that gives babies a chance to keep themselves company, emotional companionship is one of your goals. Child: "In my dream, a big monster was chasing me." Mother: "Wow, how big? As big as a giraffe, or a house, or a big mountain?" Child: "Bigger, Mom. Just his mouth was as big as a mountain." Mother: "Whoa, that's huge. I think it's the biggest monster I've ever heard of. I can see why you felt really scared. Did it look like any kind of animal you've seen? Was it one solid color, or did its coat have a pattern like dots or stripes?" Child: "It was purple with green spots." Likely not true, but instead a post hoc elaboration, which is fine and good, since accuracy is not the purpose of this dialogue. Through this relaxed and intimate exchange, your child is shifting from the role of persecuted victim to playful storyteller. Now it's just Noah and Mom and the polka dot monster sitting in the family room in the soft light of morning. The next time a predator shows up in Noah's dreamscape, the playful embellishments he's invented and the homey memory of sharing with Mom can help shape the narrative. Ask your child if he'd like you to type up his dreams or stories or write them down in a journal. Even if he's old enough to do this himself, you want to make it easy and avoid turning the enterprise into a homework-style assignment. If he accepts your offer to be his scribe, you can follow with, "Would you like to illustrate the text?" Your curiosity and respect turns fear into creativity and forges a further bridge between scary images and a calm, protective parent. You can also read the story back to him. Children love it when Mom or Dad gives a dramatic interpretation of their creation. Conversation closers. A nice way to end a chat is, "I have to go make a call for work, start dinner, get dressed to go out, but this has been a very interesting conversation. Thank you." This might feel formal, but it conveys how valuable the exchange was to you and also teaches your child how to express appreciation. When the dialogue is not as pleasurable, for example, when you and your child hold different points of view,
Watch out for the trap of thinking you have to keep plowing ahead until you reach consensus. Once child or parent runs out of emotional fuel, it's hard to see the other person's side. Instead of hammering away with reason and logic, stretching to come up with a creative solution that pleases everyone, or giving in, you can defer decisions and further discussion. Phrases that don't bow to or dismiss your child's passion, desperation, or urgency have the additional value of modeling techniques she can use when faced with peer pressure as she enters the middle school years. I hear you. I see your point, but I need some time to think this over. I need to talk with your mother about that. We'll revisit this after I've slept on it. This is new for me. I haven't put my mind to it yet. I don't know the answer, but I can find out more and we'll talk about it tomorrow. And it's sometimes appropriate to simply say no. A fancy version of no that's easy to remember uses the acronym ACE, A-C-E. Acknowledge what the child wishes. I realize you don't want to come home now because you and Sophia haven't finished decorating the treehouse, and Sophia's mom invited you to sleep over. Provide context. I have to say no this time because you have a game starting at 9 tomorrow, and you need to sleep in your own bed so you'll be rested and ready to play. Offer genuine empathy. I know it's hard to leave when you're having so much fun. Still, we need to get back home. It's time to say our goodbyes. You're the authority, and even if your child wishes she could have the sleepover, it's ultimately more reassuring to her that you are reliably in charge. Clearing space for conversations. When parents come to see me about a child who is uncooperative or unhappy at home, I ask about the source of the friction. What percentage of your communication with your child consists of nagging, reminding, or chastising? The parents are consistently rueful, exaggerated, pure mea culpa. 90%? 100%? This is never true. These parents have all sorts of interesting, unscripted conversations with their kids, but their confession tells me they're often in "be careful" mode. They don't trust the child to manage ordinary daily responsibilities, so they compulsively nag and chastise. I then ask how much time their child spends absorbed in screen-based activities. Typical verbal response: too much. Nonverbal: sad facial expression, lowered head shaking back and forth, hands raised with open palms in gesture of resigned helplessness. The reason I ask about nagging and screen time is to raise the parents' awareness about the cost of these entrenched habits. Squabbling with parents and playing with devices too often consumes much of a child's day outside of school. This leaves little room for intimate, free-range dialogue. Every conversation is waiting in the wings for its cue. The child senses that a parent is both ready to listen and devoted to offering a generous yes and to expand the discussion. Rich parent-child discourse flows from spontaneous moments protected by an unspoken set of rules. The parent is trustworthy. What's said to you stays with you. Respectful. You don't act mocking or dismissive. Curious. You ask questions and are eager to hear more. Genuinely interested. You don't nod reflexively, but ask for clarification when you don't understand. Attuned. When your child telegraphs seriousness, excitement, or puzzlement, you aren't too preoccupied to notice. Further, you can be relied upon to actively fend off distractions to listen and respond thoughtfully. Patient. You often let the conversation continue.